We're in Acts chapter 14 this morning, and we'll be looking particularly at the words of Paul that he gave to those who were seeking to call he and Barnabas gods. Last week, as we were going through chapter 14, we came to an event that happened when Paul arrived in Lystra. Lystra was a very rural area. Some would refer to it as into the wilds. It was a population of very uneducated and superstitious people. It was a place Paul would visit at least and as much as three times. It was probably the place also where Timothy was born. Now, as they've come to this place, you notice that they're not coming to a synagogue because this is a very heavy Gentile area, not of great Jewish population. The common Greek classification of the population would probably be barbarian. And upon his arrival, we saw that Paul began to preach, and he's preaching in the Greek language to those who would listen and those who could understand. The language, as he spoke, was not going to be understood by all, but there was a man nearby who was born crippled and was listening very, very closely to what Paul was saying. And guided by the Spirit, Paul looked at this man intently. He could see that this man was hearing. By grace, he had come to truly hear the word of salvation. Faith comes by hearing, and it was apparent that this man was hearing. So Paul, in a very loud voice, as we talked about, told the man, commanded him to stand up straight on his feet. Not only did he do it, but he leaped and he walked. And sometimes we forget the extent of the miracle. The man was born lame, unable to walk, crippled, which means he never used his legs. So what do we know about muscles and tendons and various other things? If we don't use them, they atrophy. So this man really had nothing in his legs to work with, just the skin and bones. But upon the command of Paul, instantaneous muscle, tendon, ligament regeneration, instantaneous, so that the man upon the command would not only stand up, but he would leap. It's easy to miss those details because we just think maybe of a man, our picture is just someone sitting there, their legs aren't doing anything at the time, then all of a sudden their legs are doing something. But there had to be instantaneous regeneration of everything that was necessary, not only for him to stand, but to walk and to leap. It's an astounding miracle. And we could spend our time on it today, but what I want to do today is deal with the reaction to the miracle and then the reaction to the reaction. First, the reaction. Verse 11, chapter 14, while when the people saw what Paul had done, they raised their voices, saying in the Lycaonian language, "The gods have come down to us in the likeness of men." Now, Paul spoke to him in Greek, but even those in the crowd who did not understand the language, they obviously saw the miracle. And what happened next? Well, they raised their voices in the Lycaonian language, which, to the best of my knowledge, as I could study and find out, was a combination of Greek and Hittite. And in that language, their own native language, they said, "The gods have come down to us in the likeness of men." Now there's a space of time before Paul and Barnabas react. And the reason is why it's given to us, because these people spoke in a language that Paul and Barnabas were not familiar with, and were only hearing bits and pieces. So there would be a delay in their reaction, but the people were remembering some old Greco-Roman mythology. The story of how Jupiter or Zeus and Mercury or Hermes came in human form to a nearby region of Phrygia. And there was also a temple of Jupiter or Zeus in Lystra. So it's interesting to note there in verse 12, Barnabas they called Zeus and Paul Hermes or Mercury. It's just a little aside, but it gives us an understanding of the difference between these two men. Obviously, Barnabas was more impressive, and Paul was not. And we read Paul's own descriptions of himself. He doesn't describe himself as a robust human being, but Barnabas was. So they called him the big guy, the mythological big guy. They called him Jupiter or Zeus. And they called Paul Mercury's or Hermes. They said, "They have come to us in human form." And Paul was called Mercury or Hermes because he was the messenger of the gods and the spokesman for Zeus. Hermes was, according to legend, the inventor of speech. And we get our word hermeneutics from Hermes. So we see in verse 13, "Then the priest of Zeus, whose temple was in front of their city, brought oxen and garlands to the gates, intending to sacrifice with the multitudes." So they would make these garlands of different plant pickings and cuttings, and they would place them around the necks of the animal that was going to be sacrificed to show that these were the ones that were going to be sacrificed unto the gods. Well, in verse 14, "But then the apostles, Barnabas and Paul, they heard this. And they tore their clothes and ran in among the multitude, crying out and saying, 'Men, why are you doing these things? We also are men with the same nature as you, and preach to you that you should turn from these useless things to the living God, who made the heaven, the earth, the sea, and all the things that are in them, who in bygone generations allowed all nations to walk in their own ways. Nevertheless, he did not leave himself without witness, and that he did good, gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness.'" Well, some of the people spoke Greek and must have told Paul and Barnabas what was going on. So we have that when they heard this. So again, there's this gap of time between they're not knowing what the people are saying and what is about to happen. Somebody tells them, and now we get the reaction to the people's reaction. "When they heard this, they tore their clothes." This was a great sign of distress and anguish. And beginning with verse 16 or 15, they gave their response, their reaction to what the people were doing, what the people were saying. And so they begin. We can find a pattern. When Paul spoke to the Jews, he usually dealt with how Jesus was the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. But with the Gentiles, that was not something he could use. So he would look at their idolatry and he would tell them that they were pursuing the wrong God and would serve then to introduce the true God. We can compare his preaching here in chapter 14 with that in Athens. We will in just a moment. But we look at the content of his message. First, he sets up a contrast. And the contrast is this. It's between them or their gods and he starts off with the contrast between Paul and Barnabas and their gods. He says to them, "We are also men of the same nature as you." The same nature, the same passions. Even in the pagan mind, there was an understanding between the nature of divine nature and that of the human nature. And so Paul makes it clear, because we are not divine, we are improper objects of worship. We need to offer a sacrifice, not to be sacrificed to. But note that Paul was quick to point out, to begin his message, with the creator-creature distinction. This is something, of course, we'll be talking about this afternoon as well. So the first thing he does is set that up. And the second thing that he gets to is this. We preach to you that you should turn from these useless things to the living God. In essence, look at what you're doing. The sculptures, these chiseled marble statues, and what they represent, they're dead. They're absolutely dead. There is no life in them. Go ahead, ask them for rain. Ask them a question. Pray to them. See what happens. What answer will you get? They have ears and they cannot hear. They have eyes, but they cannot see. They have mouths, but they cannot speak. They are useless. There's no more life in them than there is a lucky penny, or an upside-down horseshoe, or a broken mirror. These useless things. The word means useless or of no purpose. Imagine that these people were so devoted to and proud of a temple dedicated to what was useless. And here he makes the great contrast. These things are dead. They're as dead as the minds that once conjured them. So in essence, what you need to do is turn to the living God. We've been sent by the living God to tell you of the living God. The God who has life in himself, who is the fountain of life for others. You're worshiping useless and lifeless images. Images who never lived. These Zeus, Jupiter, Hermes, they never ever existed except for in the mind of somebody. They never walked the face of the earth. They never walked across the skies. They never, ever existed, and yet there's a temple built to them. And they're devoted to it. They're proud of it. These who never live, they cannot give life, nor anything else. The only thing that they can give is a source of income to the ones who chisel their images. the living God. How do we know the living God? Well, Paul will say we know the living God by what he does. That you should turn from these useless things to the living God who made the heaven, the earth, the sea, and all the things that are in them. The living God who made all things, who in bygone generations allowed the nations to walk in their own ways. The living God, known by what he's done. He made the heavens, he made the earth, the sea, and all that is in them. He is a living God also because there are living things still. He sustains what he created. All created beings, the whole universe, and all that's in it, whatever exists, angels, men, animals, fish, birds, the living God is the one who gave life to all. The only non-created being is God. Everything else is created. And that is, to me, one of the most wonderful titles. The living God. You see, every time you see life, no matter what it is, if it has life, God created it. But it even goes beyond that, that even inanimate objects exist because God created them. Even the marble that they used to carve the likeness of their gods was made by God. Now, this idea, as we mentioned before, was repeated in Acts chapter 17 as Paul was in the Areopagus, and he was speaking to the best of the Greek minds of the time. I think it's really interesting that when he's speaking to the ignorant as well as the learned, he doesn't change the story. He brings the same thing to them. He starts off with God who created everything. And so in Acts 17, in verse 24, after telling them about the God that they did not know about, he says, this God, God who made the world and everything in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, since he gives life, gives to all life, breath, and all things. And he's made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and boundaries of their dwellings, so that they should seek the Lord in hope that they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As also some of your own poets have said, for we also are his offspring. We are his creation. In Jeremiah chapter 10 and verse 10, Jeremiah says, but the Lord is the true God. He is the living God and everlasting King. Jesus says in John chapter 5 and verse 26, for as the Father has life in himself, so he has granted the Son to have life in himself. None of these supposed gods ever raised the dead, because they never lived themselves. And so they never had life to give. By the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and all the host of them by the breath of his mouth, as the psalmist says in Psalm 33 and verse 6. Maybe you're tired of hearing about it. Of course, this past week was the eclipse. And people who probably never looked up or spent that much time looking up were all looking up. It was almost as if they were expecting. It's kind of a picture that you think if Jesus was returning, this would be what it looks like. And many of the people, when they were asked, when they saw it, what was it like? Many of them said, it was spiritual. And indeed it was, because these pagans were able to look up and see the movement of planets that God had instilled in the first days of creation. You can't help but look up and see the movement of the planets and say, well, that was quite an accident. Even some would say, well, this is quite a coincidence that this is happening here in this time. Well, no, it's so predictable, because God has placed these laws of the universe to do the things that they're supposed to do and the plans to move the way they're supposed to do, that know exactly what year the next one is coming to this particular area. The God who has been unknown to you, Paul gets to them now as we return to chapter 14. This God, he says in verse 16, who in bygone generations allowed all nations to walk in their own ways. For those in Lystra, it was to walk in ignorance and superstition and idolatry. Why? Because God had a people that he had separated for himself. But now in his plan of redemption, it is bringing in the Gentiles as he had promised he would do. And so they are now, those who sat in darkness are now to see a bright light. In Psalm 124 and verse 8, our help is in the name of the Lord who made the heaven and the earth. This God, now is revealing himself to you. That time has come. The interim time is over. But in the meantime, in verse 17, nevertheless, he did not leave himself without witness, in that he did good. He gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness. We may not see it, but in verse 17, he's still contrasting the true and living God with their gods. Because to them, the gods were behind the weather and agriculture. Zeus was also the god of rain. Jupiter, the god of seasons, or Mercury, the distributor of food. Because as they changed from Greek to Roman, some of the properties and powers they had changed as well. But Paul reminds him, it's the living God that has done this. He did good. He gave us rain from heaven, filling our hearts with food and gladness. The living God. It may be the most important name and attribute of our God, the living God. A few years ago, there was a popular fad, if you will, like today we have about Jesus, he gets us. A few years back, it was God's not dead. There's even a song where on the chorus over and over again, they would shout, God's not dead. It's true. But do we derive any comfort from it? You see, you can be a deist and believe that. You can be a deist and believe that God's not dead. But a deist believes also that even though God's alive, he's not doing anything with the world. He created it and wound it up like a big old clock, and now he's letting it wind down. But the living God is seen by what takes place. The fact that life continues, new life, new seasons. But it's more than just the temporal. With the ignorant and learned, Paul still stated the same thing in the same place. He would establish the reality of the living God and then move to the God-man. It's something we need to hear. We need to come back to, because often we live our lives like the living God. Well, that's an occasional thing. We're bombarded with pharmaceutical idols, self-help, social media idols. Every single day there is something trying to take us away to worship it. But when you're up against it, when you're given the worst news that you could possibly ever hear, how wonderful it is to know the living God. On a bright, sunshiny day, how good it is to know the living God. But without Christ as your Savior, how fearful a thing it is to fall into the hands of the living God. But the living God is so important because that means He has life. And He is able to give life to all. Not just physical life, but even more importantly, spiritual life, eternal life. By His grace, He raises those who are dead in sins and trespasses. He raises them to new life. In the living God, through the work of Christ, by the Spirit of God, through the Word of God, people are regenerated. They are born again. They receive new life. The living God is not a slogan. It's our only hope. A God who lives is a God also who loves. Who loves His people enough that He would send His only begotten Son to die for their sins so that they could be accepted by Him into His fellowship. That's a living God. And when you contrast that to carved statues of Jupiter and of Zeus, how insulting it is to tell a human being, here's your gods. And how strange it is that when we say our God lives and He will indwell the hearts of His people, and people look and say, I find that hard to believe. But I do believe that the planets affect our lives. Who's the loser? The living God. Every single day, we should have that echo through our minds. Because we're going to talk about a God who's different from us. He never sleeps or slumbers. And nobody ever raises an objection to that. We're delighted in that. He never sleeps or slumbers. It's a great difference. It's also a great peace. And it is my prayer as we close that you know this peace. If not, Christ still calls. And by the power of His Spirit, if you hear that call, you can answer. Let's stand together for prayer.